Good afternoon. I'm Betsy Cannon-Smith, Alumni Secretary at the College, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our third Amherst Connects, the telephone lecture series, with Anston Bosman, Associate Professor of English. We're here in his office in Johnson Chapel on a beautiful sunny day in Amherst. Professor Bosman today will be speaking on Globalizing Shakespeare, New Languages, Cultures, and Stages. Anston Bosman has been teaching at Amherst since 2000. He was born in Cape Town, South Africa, the son of a physician and an anti-apartheid lawyer, both of whom were crazy about Shakespeare. He studied comparative literature in Europe and the U.S. and is currently finishing a book on the earliest European translations and adaptations of Shakespeare. Professor Bosman works closely with the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., taking students on research trips to the nation's capital and writing regularly for the Folger's flagship journal, Shakespeare Quarterly. Supplemental reading suggested by Professor Bosman can also be found on the alumni website, and we welcome your feedback and hope you will join us on our next call in May with Professors Walter Nicholson and Jessica Reyes on economic perspectives on healthcare reform. Professor Bosman, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Betsy. Hello. It's a pleasure to connect with you all, spread across the country as you are, and indeed across the globe. Thanks to Betsy, to Melanie Sage, and to Ellie Ballard for the invitation to talk with you today. And thanks to you all for listening in live or via podcast. Many of you I've worked with in the 10 years that I've been at Amherst, and many more are from classes way before that, as far back as the 1940s. Welcome to you all, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. And if you call back later, you can play the Puzzle Master with Will Shortz from the New York Times. I'm kidding. In his dedicatory poem to William Shakespeare's First Folio of 1623, Ben Jonson wrote of his friend and rival that he was not of an age, but for all time. Today I'd like us to think about a complementary elasticity for Shakespeare, Shakespeare stretching not over time, but over space. Might it also be possible to say of Shakespeare that he was and is not of one place, but for all the world? Can we think of Shakespeare not merely as a native of Stratford-upon-Avon, but instead as a kind of global nomad? And if so, what qualities of Shakespeare's works might account for such worldwide mobility? What light might the translation and adaptation of those works shed on our global citizenship, on the always opposing forces of cultural persistence and change? In the supplementary reading I provided, you'll find an essay of mine that explores the subject of Shakespeare and globalization from a more comprehensive scholarly point of view. The chapter is forthcoming in the new Cambridge Companion to Shakespeare. I don't want to replicate that argument this afternoon, although I'm happy to talk about it during the question period. Instead, what I figured I'd do is take a step back from that broad survey and simply present a few of Shakespeare's texts that touch on questions of contingency and mobility, and then comment on a couple of recent Shakespeare performances I've seen with which some of you might be familiar. Then we'll open out into a free-form discussion. But first, let's start with a Shakespearean fantasy of stability, of fixed form. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark whose worths are known, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error, and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. Like most of Shakespeare's sonnets, this poem, Sonnet 116, makes an argument. Indeed, it is an argument. And the argument goes like this. Love is unchanging and unending, and anything that is otherwise is not love at all. If this can be proved false, then the poem itself will dissolve. But of course, that's impossible. After all, here is the poem, in front of me. So no error can have occurred. And so true love, like a true poem, is indeed an ever-fixed mark, unwavering, immutable, and unconditional. The problem with this argument, of course, is its abstraction. It proclaims an ideal and has no truck with reality. You can see why Sonnet 116 is a popular poem for weddings, but it's surely not very useful for actual marriages. It starts by proudly insisting that it won't admit impediments, but what else does life present us with? In its relentless singularity and impersonality, the poem offers us little more than a fable. There's a limit to what any dream of coherence, of rootedness, can offer us. Now let's consider a very different fantasy, one that tells instead of complex flows across shifting landscapes. These lines are neither singular nor impersonal. On the contrary, they pass between two specific characters on a particular desert island. A shipwrecked prince hears the song on the water as he mourns his father's death in a storm, and he wanders towards its invisible and constantly retreating source, hearing it intermittently die down, then strike up again. Here it is. Full fathom five thy father lies. Of his bones are coral made. Those are pearls that were his eyes. Nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Sea nymphs hourly ring his knell. Hark! Now I hear them. Ding-dong bell! The sea change, of which the spirit Ariel sings to Prince Ferdinand in The Tempest, is the opposite of the sonnet's ever-fixed mark, not only in the story it tells, but in the manner of its telling. This is not an argument, but a kind of dream of motion and transformation. Or again, the lines are a game Ariel is playing with Ferdinand, whose father, the King of Naples, is not actually dead, but merely hidden. Inside the game, Ferdinand's father is the opposite of the constant sonnet poet. He is much shaken by the tempest, which turns him into someone else, something else. In this metamorphosis, this translation, to use the word that Shakespeare deploys elsewhere, something is lost, but something else gained. Bones become coral and eyes pearls, and an outlandish music celebrates the birth of something rich and strange. This dream world, or game world, is of course a model for the play world. Unlike his sonnet, bound by conventions of every kind, Shakespeare's theatrical lines set their own rules. They're vital but mysterious, unsettled and unsettling. One word for the kind of play Shakespeare indulges here would be error. As in Sonnet 116, we should hear in this term not only the modern English sense of a miscalculation, but also the primary Latin sense of an act of roaming or wandering, as in knight-errant. Ariel's song not only leads Ferdinand to a mistaken judgment, he incorrectly believes his father's drowned, but also sets him on a devious or winding course, far from home into a brave new world of dislocated identities and unintended consequences. In this respect, The Tempest could be called a comedy of errors. Its island setting, like the coast of Illyria in Twelfth Night, or the Forest of Arden in As You Like It, is a place of exile, full of relentless longing and drastic renegotiation. Here, the mobility of which the sonnet was so intolerant is in fact to be celebrated. What the poem closes down, the play opens up, and that openness is what has made The Tempest so malleable over four centuries and many more languages and cultures. Nevertheless, error has its dark side too. Consider, for instance, the words of Horatio as he surveys the corpses littering the stage at the very end of Hamlet. The awful scene, he says, is the unexpected outcome of what he calls plots and errors. And he undertakes to explain them to the Danish courtiers, the English ambassadors, and the Norwegian Prince Fortinbras, who has just come from the war in Poland. But since, so jump upon this bloody question, you from the Polack Wars and you from England are here arrived, give order that these bodies high on a stage be placed to the view, and let me speak to the yet unknowing world how these things came about. So shall you hear of carnal, bloody, and unnatural acts, of accidental judgments, casual slaughters, of deaths put on by cunning and forced cause, and in this upshot, purposes mistook fallen on the inventors' heads. All this can I truly deliver. These lines take us about as far from the ever-fixed mark of poetic ideals as one could possibly imagine. The castle of Elsinore is a force field of error in the tragic mode, but its history is recognizable as our own. Like Horatio, we live in a world of sudden alteration and forced removal, where borders are seldom secure and missions rarely accomplished. Hamlet shakes our fantasies of settled communities, progressing inevitably from traceable origins to certain futures. But this is precisely why the play, and the disoriented, truly fatherless prince at its center, speaks to us today. We have our tragic and our comic moments. Some days we're Hamlet, sometimes we're Ferdinand, but our time and place confronts us with those young men's dilemmas: exile, emigration, colonization, a tangle of languages and ethnicities, a contest over identity, territory, and legitimacy. In this newly global world, we need Shakespeare the poet of fixity less than we do Shakespeare the wanderer, the shape-shifter, the play-maker. More than as an immovable bastion of culture, Shakespeare has survived because he unleashes a disruptive force of innovation and change. In thinking about these comments today, I've been moved by the account of Shakespeare's genius in Jonathan Bate's simply titled book, The Genius of Shakespeare, in which Bate discusses two particular qualities of Shakespeare's works that might be relevant here. He calls them aspectuality and performativity. By aspectuality, he means that the literary work can be held up to different faces and entered at different points, that it disperses the authorial voice so that, unlike in an Emerson essay or in a novel by George Eliot, the authorial voice is surrendered entirely to the voices of all the characters as they compete over meanings and values. Shakespeare's drama allows each character to embody a different aspect. Each character is essential to the whole, but only one character speaks at once, and the author does not single out any individual character or aspect as the embodiment of truth. So the value here is ambiguity, its antonym singularity. So much for aspectuality. What does Bate mean by performativity? Well, all literary works have to be performed by their readers. Anyone who's taken a poetry class at Amherst can tell you that. But only the drama is fully performative, because it is premised on the act of impersonation. In this way, drama is uniquely like a game. That's why we call them plays. They are unlike arguments, to which even poems like a Shakespeare sonnet can be reduced. In writing the essay in the supplementary reading, you'll see that I followed these two aspects into three areas of Shakespeare's worldwide dissemination, following ways in which both that aspectuality and that performativity have been realized. I made a division into three different modes of transmission: the actor, the author, and the ether. By this I meant to say that Shakespeare is disseminated globally by a network of performers and directors through staging, by a network of texts which comprise writers, editors, and translators, and a digital network, new, although perhaps not as new as we think, deploying a range of media and devices. But I could have structured my essay, an impossible topic, Shakespeare and globalization, very differently. I could instead have talked about world regions and looked at how various large swathes of the globe have domesticated or made Shakespeare strange. A tripartite division that would have been easy to make would have been between, say, Germany, India, and Japan. In Germany, the first country that took Shakespeare to its heart in terms of its own literary canon, Shakespeare was valuable in the 18th century, especially for nationalistic reasons. The Germans, who formed their nation later than many others, saw in Shakespeare a model of a national poet, someone who they could adapt to their own ends, and the first classic translations into German by people like Schiller, Schlegel, and Tieck, became classics of German literature itself. As you probably know, in the 19th and even the 20th century, Shakespeare was frequently referred to as German. "Unser Shakespeare," said one German critic. And in part, that was because he appeared to them to conform to the values and styles of their own time. This was in no small measure a result of the excellent translations formed so early and so completely by German writers. A very different kind of globalization of Shakespeare happened throughout the British Empire, reaching its height in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The classic example of this is India, where Shakespeare's work was imported as part of the cultural baggage of empire, but later took a series of distinctive turns unanticipated by British promoters. Growing up in South Africa, I encountered much the same model as this Indian colonial style. Shakespeare was clearly imported as part of the Victorian gold and diamond rush from the 1890s leading through the Anglo-Boer War, and seen as a cornerstone of Anglicization and the imposition of British values on the colonial margin. But over time, those values, as it were, struck back at the empire, so that indigenous South African groups, much like their Indian counterparts, found themselves using Shakespeare, as it were, as a tool to dismantle the master's house. This process is still going on, and last year, a theatre in Cape Town collaborated with the Royal Shakespeare Company to perform The Tempest in a production that cast, for the first time, distinguished global black South African actors in the role of the colonized servants of Prospero. A third and distinctive example would be Japan, something I had experience of when I visited Doshisha to teach in 2008. In Japan, the appropriation of Shakespeare was neither nationalistic nor colonialist, but rather intercultural and aesthetic. I was happy to witness, while in Japan, versions of no, kabuki, and bunraku theater, and to see Shakespearean versions of them too. Many of you may know the superb films of Kurosawa, or perhaps, slightly more arcane, the theater productions of Yukio Ninagawa, which have come to New York and Chicago, as well as Europe in the last decade or so. Here the value was less on the politics and more on the aesthetics of Shakespeare's work. Extremely beautiful, tragic productions with cherry blossoms falling and the ritualistic gestures of an ancient samurai world intercut with contemporary Western costumes and manners. I want to talk now about two recent productions on stage in New York, each of them transnational in its own way, making a rather different claim, and thinking about how Shakespeare is performed even globally in America now. The first of those is the play Lear by the Korean-born American playwright Youngjin Lee, which I saw at the Soho Rep about 6 weeks ago. You may have read the excellent review of this production in the New Yorker magazine. This is a remarkable avant-garde adaptation of Shakespeare's King Lear, in which Lear never appears. In many respects, the play seemed to me a kind of response to a sad time, a deracinated, disinherited time in America, a time bereft of an older generation's certainties, fatherless, a time preoccupied with cliffs and storms, with the chaotic world outside, but ever more intruding on our safe, ordered quarters. To start with, there's the stage space, and I would encourage you to go to the website for the Soho Rep, which we noticed in our supplementary reading, for some fantastic visuals of this theatre. The stage space is ornate, it's claustrophobic, like a jewel box in red and gold. Sitting in the small pitched seats, you feel as though you're inside this box, toys jostling against the actor's gem-like exteriors. Such an artificial world, this jewel box space, we can't help thinking about what's outside in the real world. And the actors speak of it all the time. Even though we are never to intervene in Shakespeare's tale proper, we don't ever forget about it. This box in which Regan, Cordelia, and Goneril discuss the fortunes of their father in the storm outside is also a kind of echo chamber. The sounds we hear are not only Lee's, but Shakespeare's, and they are often inarticulate, howling, or repetitive, nothing, never, never, and so on. But there are also terrible shudders that shake the entire box of the theatre, as though a train is passing or a jackhammer is breaking into the box, or the storm is finally upon us. Under Lee's adaptation, of course, it's Shakespeare's play that gets shaken up. There is no Lear in this version. We meet only his three daughters, played by a trio of African-American actresses, and the brothers Edmund and Edgar, played by paunchy white guys. The brothers are far less interesting than the sisters. It's as though Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, sidelined its comic duo in favor of Ophelia and her girlfriends. The power of the production lies in bringing together for much longer than is really comfortable the three women that Shakespeare's plot kept firmly apart. Of course, this trio has fascinated adapters from Nahum Tate in 1681 to Jane Smiley in 1991, but the choice of black actresses makes these royals more embattled even than usual. Writing in The New Yorker, Hilton Ulse took this as a comment on the fact that most black women must act or pass in order to be accepted in a society that is not of their making. But I confess my own mind went in a different direction, towards the princesses of a supposedly post-racial America, the Obama girls, sitting in the White House while their father raged against the storm outside. As the Goneril and Regan debated whether or not Gloucester's blinding had happened in the snow, a blizzard was hitting Washington, a contingency that the script could not have foreseen, but on which performance could readily grasp new meanings. There was snow, too, in Sam Mendes' bridge project production of As You Like It at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, BAM. But this time, the snow was visible on stage, in the first breathtaking sight of the Forest of Arden, a kind of wintry desert of bare tree trunks in the center of which a wooden bridge crossed over a ditch filling up with snow. Most productions hesitate to literalize what this play calls winter and rough weather, although Duke Sr. makes it clear that he prefers the wild to the envious court. Here are his words. "Here feel we but the penalty of Adam, the season's difference, as the icy fang and churlish chiding of the winter's wind, which even when it bites and blows upon my body till I shrink with cold, I smile and say, this is no flattery. These are counselors that feelingly persuade me what I am." Sounds like Amherst in January. This was the very opposite of young Jean Lee's Lear. The claustrophobic box had been exchanged for the storm outside, bracing perhaps, but a land of errors all the same. This was austerity Shakespeare at its breathtaking best, a time of renunciation with clear pertinence to its Anglo-American and indeed its global audience. Writing in the New York Times, Charles Isherwood quipped that for much of its running time, Mr. Mendes' As You Like It might almost be retitled Some Like It Cold, so insistent are the shadows flitting at everyone's heels, threatening to forestall the possibility of things ever turning out happily. The quadruple wedding that concludes the play, not presided over by the god Hymen, but by a human, seems a minor miracle and takes place modestly, at night in the forest with strings of lamps as the mark of festivity. There is a lively dance, but Jaques' speech of congratulations to the newlyweds strikes the key note. You leave Mr. Mendes' production with a nagging suspicion that the dancing measures may not last long. The triumph of love has rarely seemed so fragile, so tenuous. For my part, this seemed not only a beautiful but a timely vision, a sober 2010 counterpoint to zany versions like As You Like It, a California concoction, a 2006 production I saw at the Pasadena Playhouse that highlighted gender confusion, cross-dressing, and gay marriage, a fantasy that later events were swift to tamp down. The story of the Bridge Project began 5 years ago when Sam Mendes and Kevin Spacey figured out that they were each working on opposite sides of the Atlantic from where they had grown up, and figured out a collaboration which a Shakespeare play and initially a Chekhov play would be combined, in which a new model of producing would emerge from combining London and New York stage traditions, drawing on different skills to initiate these classical plays over an extended rehearsal period. They would perform not only at BAM, at the Old Vic in London, but also on tour worldwide over 11 months. So this Anglo-American cast, that we can see now, The Tempest, the second play in the band current Bridge Project season, is completing its run, have traveled to Singapore, New Zealand, Spain, and Germany, and will conclude their journey at the ancient theatre of Epidavros in Greece. Initially, this double bill of As You Like It and The Tempest was rather to have been As You Like It and Chekhov's Three Sisters. But for reasons I don't yet know, perhaps one of you does, The Tempest stood in for The Three Sisters this time. But in fact, we need not wait long for such a double bill. The Kennedy Center has just announced that this coming fall, Chekhov's Three Sisters will be performed in a double bill with a new translation of Twelfth Night in Russian with English surtitles. The production is brought from Moscow to Washington by the Chekhov International Theatre Festival, and the dates are October 19th to the 23rd, 2010. There's no doubt I'll be in attendance, perhaps even with a seminar in tow. I hope you can make it too. Let me know what you think. Thank you.
All right, and we've already got some questions, and I'll start with this. Samuel Johnson wrote about Shakespeare that nothing can please many and please long, but just representations of general nature. Shakespeare is above all writers, the poet of nature, the poet that holds up to his readers a faithful mirror of manners and of life. In the writings of other poets, a character is too often an individual. In those of Shakespeare, it is commonly a species. Two questions related to that, Professor Bosman. One, do you agree that it is the generality or universality of Shakespeare's characters that accounts for the accessibility of his work to globalization? And two, does this emphasis on his characters act against focusing Shakespeare as poet, as Johnson does, and minimize the importance of his language, his place as poet, as Johnson preferred to think of him, as opposed to author or dramatist? And we must credit this to our friend Paul Ruxin from the Class of 65, who chairs the Folger Library Board in Washington.
Paul Ruxin writes a mean question. I have to say that the terms generality and universality always make me a little uneasy. It's so easy to feel that something is universal that can rapidly turn out to be a very local phenomenon. Rather than talking, for example, about the play's timelessness, I prefer to follow Marjorie Garber in talking about the play's unusual timeliness. That is to say, their openness allows us to enter them from where we are with an uncanny frequency and variability. Maybe that's what universality in art means, resilience to change based on an artifact's elasticity. But I think it's very difficult to tell whether something is universal or general outside of one's own location. For example, today I was teaching A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I asked the students what they made of the fact that the Fairy King and Queen, Titania and Oberon, are fighting over an Indian changeling boy. Well, the short answer is they're writing midterms and they made nothing of it at all. So clearly that was an almost impossibly marginal or local detail for them in the play. But of course, in Shakespeare's England, this would have been not marginal at all, but a fascinating and exotic kind of absent center to the supernatural quarrel in the forest. Similarly, in India itself, this figure, although he never appears on stage, is crucial in determining the play's relationship to something like the rise of mercantilism and the East India Company. It's so difficult to determine universality and generality, but what I will say is that the theatre is unusually porous in this respect, more porous than poetry, because it draws on the poetic power of language as well as a whole series of other languages, such as, shall we say, the powerful iconic visual representations of something like the balcony scene or Lear on the cliff at Dover. Also, Shakespeare's universality draws on what Tolstoy called the unusual emotive gesture in Shakespeare's plays, things that are very hard to capture in most lyric poems. By this he means not just visual representations or classic poetic language, but rather those extraordinary moments of silence, gesture, phatic utterance, sighs, cries that are incorporated in a play text. My students admit that when they read the texts, their eyes skim over such moments, but in performance, they come alive and bring with them, in their liveliness, a whole range of poetic subtlety that was missing from their first read also.
Thank you. You describe these productions as arguments in favor of the good, fluidity, and against the bad, fixity. Can these very abstract themes misrepresent and oversimplify Shakespeare?
I think the interesting feature of Shakespeare's drama is that misrepresentation is, as it were, built into the situation to begin with. In a play like The Midsummer Night's Dream, just present in my mind from today's lecture, an action in a theater is described as presenting or disfiguring the original story. And, of course, Shakespeare's own use of his sources, which are global in reach, could be described as a kind of misrepresentation. For example, historians feel very poorly about the way he treated various English kings because he wanted to give their historical narratives a kind of tragic arc. Well, we don't want to call this misrepresentation because it's Shakespeare, so we say something like shaping or refashioning, or perhaps we talk about alchemical transformations. But I don't think there's any simplifying at stake here. Just look, for example, at some of the famous versions of children's Shakespeare. There's some astonishing short movies of Shakespeare plays made by the Welsh television channel, and they can be gotten from UK. They're animated short children's versions. And they are extraordinarily powerful versions of the play in that they detonate precisely this magic, emotive, gestural, iconic quality that the plays contain without losing too much. What they lose, of course, is the verbal complexity, but I would remind us that most of us, including yours truly, miss that verbal complexity not only every time it's performed, but every time we read it. So I would say that the solution is to see more, to do more, to see more versions of the play in performance, and to read it repeatedly at different stages in your life where you're likely to benefit from that aspectual quality Jonathan Bate talks about.
Great. Now here's a bit of history. On April 3rd, 1949, NBC broadcast Julius Caesar to a new 14-city network in America. The cast of 50 Amherst College Maskers made the trip to the nation's capital to put on the first theatrical performance at the Folger Shakespeare Library Theater. The hour and three-quarter program was underwritten by Saucony Vacuum Oil, the company of which Henry Clay Folger, Amherst 1879, and our benefactor of the library, was chairman of the board 25 years earlier. Would you speak to the significance of this Sunday afternoon telecast?
Boy, I wish I had seen this. I am. This is not within my specialty, I have to say. But I'm thrilled to learn of it, and I can't wait to see what documentation we have. I do think that that the history of Shakespeare in American media has been significantly underserved. You know, it's a curious feature of American Shakespeare enthusiasm that we tend to overlook local work, particularly in a medium like early telecasting, for, shall we say, the classic British films of the period or even Hollywood versions of the plays. But some fascinating new work is being done in the area of early television and radio broadcasts of Shakespeare, which were, admittedly, often simplified or played for certain kinds of obvious appeal. I would say that the telecast you talked about should be put in the entire early American history of this kind of activity, beginning most powerfully, and I really would encourage you to see these, with silent Shakespeare itself, that is to say, early movies done without the language, but trying as hard as the actors can to transpose the linguistic register into some kind of visual and gestural medium. So I'm fascinated. I'd love to learn more. Thanks for the information.
Just a reminder, email your questions to alumseries@amherst.edu. Now, a question about the Folger, as we're talking about that. Would you talk a little bit about your relationship with the Folger, how you use that material in your own research, and the benefit of that, of course, to our student body?
The Folger really is a gem in Amherst Crown, and I think that we could not use it too much. It is, as you know, and I hope you've visited there when you've been in Washington, really a kind of collection of different resources. The research library itself, which is the premier collection of Shakespeareana globally, the Elizabethan Theatre, which is part of the Shakespeare complex and which puts on chiefly modern versions of Shakespeare plays, but also a very valuable educational and research arm that goes K through 12 all the way through to programs for graduate students and advanced professors. So I've tried to dip into as many of these aspects of the Folger as I could. And in fact, I'm aware now as I speak that there are aspects of it I am assuming or leaving out, like the really quite important conservation arm, which is engaged in retaining and preserving the treasures of that library and which is itself of global repute. But my chief uses of the library have been, firstly, in my own research, in being able to take time on Capitol Hill to immerse myself in Shakespeare's world of printed materials, but also of fantastic visual and material history. And then secondly, being able to take students to visit library and work with its materials. Nicola Courtright in the Fine Arts Department and I have taught repeatedly a seminar called Renaissance Marvels, a title rather vague, but to cover the incredible range of materials we see. And we have frequently taken students down on weekends to, let's say in one instance, see the Royal Shakespeare Company performing at the Kennedy Center, work with manuscripts in the library itself that students have prepared in advance, and to explore the nature of the research library as an institution. One of the things that makes it so difficult to value the Folger is that the rare materials limit access to some degree, and so to have seminars on official trips makes it possible for us to lay our sticky paws on some miraculous historical materials. I think that for some students, it really has had a transformative effect, akin to the kind of trips we've done to the National Gallery at the same time or on different trips to the Metropolitan Museum. Because there really is nothing like the material object to plunge you back in time and allow you to re-experience that material world of Shakespeare and his contemporaries. We also, of course, have a fantastic staff at the Folger, who many of whom are Amherst grads and who are the leaders in their fields, whether it be scholarship, editorial work, conservation, or even the decoding of obscure manuscripts, which has led to some wonderful discoveries over the years.
Excellent. We have a question about the campus and student life. Could you talk a little bit about the tradition of Shakespeare performances on campus by students? What are recent productions and how have they addressed this issue of globalization?
Well, there have been some exciting recent productions, not all of Shakespeare, but of other Renaissance dramatists too. And I'm sorry to say that I missed one of the most exciting of them, which happened in 2000, just before I arrived, a production by Eddie Kim 2000 of The Tempest, which single-handedly raised the profile of Shakespeare on campus and both modernized and exoticized The Tempest, I think, appropriately. I want to mention at this point that last week we had an extraordinary week-long residency by a British company called Actors from the London Stage, who brought Romeo and Juliet. A few years ago, they brought Macbeth to campus, and performed a kind of interesting reverse globalization, if you like. That is to say, brought a British Shakespeare company, small number, five actors, to campus, and toured a pared-down production and also visited classes. I think what was exciting about this was not just that these British actors had to come in contact with and intermingle with American styles and interpretations of Shakespeare, but also that in visiting classes across the English curriculum, everything from Caribbean poetry to classical tragedy to choreography, they were able to show students quite how varied the range of Shakespearean skills is, how wide the set is, reminding students that performance is the way back to the text, not something to distract you from it, but rather a fascinating counterpoint to the script in front of you. The question of globalization in that case was the unusual one of a British company, the owners of Shakespeare, one might say, coming to Amherst and finding that their own Shakespeare is domestic, local. It's no longer the universal Shakespeare that perhaps one once associated with the greats of the 20th century. It's now as powerful to have a figure from the Royal Shakespeare Company give a performance of a character like Hamlet or Falstaff as it is to give a performance in Los Angeles or Chicago or Washington, D.C.
Thank you. The following question reads, I have a question about the Branagh's adaptation of As You Like It, which is set in an English colonial enclave in Japan. I was made uncomfortable when watching it because there were only Western actors in the speaking roles. This makes at least some sense when they are inside the Duke's court, but when the court ventures out into Arden, the shepherds they encounter are also strangely Western. Could you speak a bit about the use of Shakespeare to try and restrict our views of a cultured audience or maintain some sort of cultural dominance by a group?
That's an extremely provoking question. I think that the one of the life forces of Shakespeare's drama is precisely to confront both individuals and groups from different places, different ranks, different cultures, and set a vibrant conversation in motion. I think there is some... It would have been curious to me if a play like The Branagh As You Like It had rather been an instance of something like Othello, or even for that matter, Titus Andronicus, plays that deal so assertively with how difficult it is to be in the position of the outsider, the marginal, that character without power who tries to assert herself or himself on the stage and in the community. In fact, there are opportunities for that in As You Like It, and it's unfortunate that the Branagh production you described doesn't take advantage of it. It seems that one of the political porosities of Shakespeare's text are visible whenever he imagines this world of cultural encounter. He doesn't see his globe as unified at all, but rather as split into a million pieces. And you don't need a play like Othello to tell you that, or even Titus Andronicus for that matter. You can even look at something like Romeo and Juliet, where the feuds between the families are seen as happening almost between two cultures. The two houses, both alike in dignity, can equally count for something like Shakespeare's view of the English relationship, let's say, with the dignified Moor, who is Othello, who speaks better than anyone else in the play, and who's able to seduce not only on an individual level the beautiful Desdemona, but also on a political level the Senate of Venice. And so it would have been intriguing to me, it's a bit of a missed opportunity what you're describing, intriguing to me to see what one could have done in that intercultural setting with a play that also heightened the intercultural theme rather than used it as a kind of exotic setting merely.
Thank you. Was Shakespeare at risk in bringing along so many pagan gods in his plays, especially that his plays spoke somehow to contemporary events?
The Renaissance itself is a kind of suturing of two worlds, the classical and the Christian. The world of ancient knowledge, which had been reawoken after the Dark Ages, alongside the very topical debates between, for example, in England, Catholics and Protestants. But Shakespeare is unusually drawn to, he's magnetically drawn to these to figures and images that resume the kind of social and symbolic energies of both pagan and Christian symbols. There's some sense that his plays demonstrate a continuity rather than a clash between them. And sometimes that clash can be downright funny and generate anachronisms. There's a certain moment in Titus Andronicus, for example, which is set in classical Rome, when someone describes overhearing another person hiding from them in a ruined monastery. Well, of course, there weren't any ruined monasteries in classical Rome, but what you notice there, this moment of anachronism, it's by no means a rare moment in Shakespeare, is the use of contemporary material to create a wormhole in time between the contemporary and the classical. At risk of using pagan gods? No, I think he was probably more at risk in using overtly Catholic symbols, the way he does in plays like Hamlet. What he's doing then is trying to pick up the residual power of Catholic icons, even in a Protestant world after the Reformation and the iconoclasm, which has great difficulty with him. But this universality or this ambiguity in Shakespeare extends too to casting a wide net over anything that has energy, anything that has talismanic or magical force, Shakespeare will use. Again, because the plays aren't reducible to a particular conclusion, but rather open out in all directions, he is a magpie in selecting from his wide range of sources. And I suspect that the classical is less for him a risk than a rich resource.
Here's an easy question. Do you believe Shakespeare is a great writer, compared to so many who are not so great? And if so, what makes him great? And is it possible to make progress in understanding his greatness and the meaning of his work?
Yes, to all of the above. One of the things I don't let my students go on about in their writing is how great Shakespeare was, because I want them to show me rather than tell me the substance of his greatness. There are extraordinary resources in Shakespeare's text itself. That cannot be denied. But I think that Shakespeare as an individual is not the end point of our investigation. In talking about Shakespeare, we're also talking about ourselves. 400 years of conversation about not just one text, but many texts for some plays, many adaptations, many translations, many performances. There's a kind of archaeology of our own civilization there, and that's what we've got on the table when Shakespeare's the subject. Not just an individual man, ingeniously talented though he was, but our own stories and the stories of everyone that links us with him.
And we have an excellent question here from a fairly recent grad and a little bit of history to share as well. You speak with great insight on the flow of Shakespeare across the wide ranges of time and place. The Bard is not an unfamiliar topic among scholars, but your research seems especially extensive and personally invested. I would love to hear you talk about your own personal relationship with Shakespeare and his works, and why you have devoted such a significant portion of your life and work to them.
I have, as a matter of fact, written about this, and happily at the time. I don't think this material is available online, so the memoir will be forthcoming. But as I said, I grew up in an environment that was filled with both a love of reading and a love of performance. And some of my most intense memories of theater from childhood come from Shakespeare's plays. The tradition in Cape Town, which I know is the case in many other parts of the world, is a slight echo of Shakespeare's original amphitheater performances, in the sense that there's a tradition of outside performances during the summertime. And this is an ideal place to take a small child, because when it misbehaves, it can be removed without incident. I was that small child, and I have never been more grateful. Even if it meant that at the age of 5, during the smothering scene in Othello, I was underneath my chair yelling, "Make it stop, make it stop." Well, perhaps because of that unfortunate incident, I've retained a special connection to Shakespeare and his works. But I think also that that my passion for the material stems from the very bridges that Shakespeare can help us make, the way in which Shakespeare is a subject so many people can enter in from so many different doors. And so that rather than having a particular interest, let's say, in an individual dramatist or poet, some people may have known or may not have known, Shakespeare rather throws you open into a world conversation in which everyone has something to contribute. There's nothing more extraordinary than moving from Amherst College to Doshisha in Kyoto, Japan, and continuing a conversation about the same play. You won't get the same responses, and you probably won't ask the same questions, but what you will have is a robust and stimulating interaction, not only about the material, but also about all the assumptions that we bring to that material. I should make it clear that none of us approaches Shakespeare without assumptions, and it's not my business to disenchant you, but rather to help you understand what the enchantment is. That's going to be different in each case. Not everyone will have hidden under their chair at 5 years old, but I hope that there are moments when both the wonder and the terror that Shakespeare's plays bring can be activated once more in each of us. That may mean finding ingenious ways to include him in your own creative or analytic work. It may mean collecting books. It may mean collecting programs. Whatever your own investment, I encourage you to pursue it.
And from an 06 grad, also to respond briefly to the student life question about recent productions. When I was a senior, an underclassman began an after-hours event called Wednesday Night Shakespeare, in which students and faculty members were invited to sit in a classroom, eat cookies, and read plays aloud. At first, there were not enough people for all the parts, so we doubled up, as per weekly casting done by email beforehand. But the crowd grew each session. I have fond memories of bringing those works to life alongside a gaggle of geeks, theater kids, and even my classics professor. It was great fun, and I hope the tradition blossomed further after I graduated. So connected to that, could you speak a little bit about any observations you have in the changing of teaching Shakespeare over time, in both your time and from what you know of Amherst past and the people on the phone who've took courses in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s.
I certainly could be wrong about this, Betsy, but my impression is that while there has for a long time been a tradition of reading Shakespeare closely as a poet and also performing his works in an amateur context on campus or in the area, for a while these two things were held to be separate activities, really different versions of the handling the same material. But what I find curious about that is that Shakespeare himself was both a poet and a man of the theater. He was literally his own boss. He sold himself as a member of the company his own plays. This is one of the reasons that they are such extraordinary plays, because they are by an accomplished poet who also knew what it was to be an actor. I would say that one of the things I've tried to bring to campus while here has been to make the conversation happen across those groups, that the theater kids, as the alum calls them, and the poetry geeks can join in conversation. This doesn't mean that they always need to agree. Sometimes there are interesting contesting values about seeing Shakespeare as a playwright chiefly, or as a poet in the first place. But I think those conversations are very worth having, not least because we understand the range of knowledge and intelligence that Shakespeare had to marshal. I think we're more Shakespearean if we try to talk about both of those features of his work at once, however difficult that may be. He, of course, would have much less difficulty, but as I like to remind my students, Shakespeare is much smarter than we are.
That is very, very good. Is there an agreed-upon Shakespeare course that our English department wishes to continue to offer, or is this something that you adapt over the years as you go?
We give, as a matter of routine, English 35 and 36. Those are each term we give a 50-person Shakespeare lecture, which has been shared among members of the department. My colleagues David Sofield and Bill Pritchard and Chick Chickering have shared it, and in recent years, also an alum and former English professor and dean at Mount Holyoke, Peter Berwick, has been sharing the lecture responsibilities. So we make a commitment to our students not just to be teaching and learning Shakespeare, but by doing it in a reasonable-sized class. Of course, we give small seminars. I'm giving one in the fall called Transnational Shakespeares, which takes up this question of globalization in a more focused research format, focusing on students' individual independent work. But we want students to be able to read the verse aloud, incorporate performances in classes, and also for it to be small enough that when the actors come to town, for example, everyone has an opportunity to play with them, quite literally, and enhance their sense of Shakespeare in a more intimate, Amherst way, rather than in a massive lecture format such as one might find, for example, at the larger Ivies.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of the hour. Thank you very much. Thank you for the good questions and the thought-provoking questions. And we appreciate your time, Professor Bosman.
Thank you, and see you all soon.